Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can say that I get a lot of value out of them. Merck Research is different from other research, which usually just cherry picks all positive or all negative charts and then falls into the trap of confirmation bias. Merck Research provides an intellectually consistent approach by going through a consistent set of relevant data and then putting it through a consistent set of frameworks, which is then summarized in a checklist and in a concise written summary. Their monthly economic and market data review provides an excellent overview of the macro landscape. It's all compiled in one place and easy to interpret chart books with written analysis. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer and get a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website MerckResearch.com/contrarian. That's Merck spelled M-E-R-K. Or you can log on to MerckResearch.com, sign up for a regular subscription, and enter the code contrarian at checkout to take advantage of this free offer. Now, on to today's episode. Artem Fokin of Caro-Kann Capital, thank you so much for joining the Contrarian Investor Podcast today. This is a bit of a unique program today because we are talking about finding compounders. As every investor knows, this is kind of the holy grail to find a company when it is still small or young or whatever enough with the potential to grow and to become one of these multi-baggers. Now, in today's day and age, as we record this on December 23rd, 2020, markets are a bit frothy, especially when it comes to growth stocks. And one could make the point, perhaps, that this is not the time to be finding any of these potential compounders. In fact, there probably aren't even any that are available publicly anyway. But you have a different approach here, somewhat different, in that you find these compounders in unusual places. And we're talking literally unusual places in that they are traded on other exchanges outside of the US. And what we're going to be calling wrong exchanges, meaning not the NASDAQ, not the NYSE, not the Amex or anything like that. So tell me about that.
Hi, Nate. Pleasure to be with you. And you're posing a great question. So let's start with a couple of premises there. First of all, what do I mean by the wrong exchange? By the wrong exchange, I mean an exchange where a natural set of buyers or potential investors who are very likely to be interested in a particular security driven by the nature of the business and the customer base and the geographic markets are generally not looking at the opportunities. So for example, if a company does business in the US, its headquarters are in the US, its customer base in the US, it would be very logical to expect that its investors should or would also be likely in the US. They would understand the market, they would understand the product, they would understand customer needs, they can do their diligence, they can travel to see the company obviously before COVID. Mm. Now, imagine that that company with that fact pattern, where 80% of revenue comes from the United States, actually trading on London AIM.
Okay.
UK investors who are more likely to be familiar with the stock because this is where the company trades may not necessarily be very, very well versed in the intricacies of the US and market for that company's product or services. At the same time, US investors may not even know about the company's existence because it's listed on what you and I agreed to call the wrong exchange. Let me give you a particular example from the investment history of mine and Karakhan Capital. About 4 years ago, slightly more, I found a stock that of a company called GAN, G-A-N, and for disclaimer purposes, Karakhan Capital and its affiliates are still long shares of GAN. This is not investment advice. I'm using this as purely for illustrative purposes and for educational purposes only. So we found a company called GAN. GAN was trading on the AIM exchange in London, which is junior exchange of London Stock Exchange. But the CEO, as well as key management team members, were based in the US. And about 80% of its revenue was coming from the US, from the US clients. The company was making a software, it was a software as a service company for casinos to bring casinos online and develop online presence. Obviously, looking back, it has become a big trend, and the GAN benefited not only from its execution, but also from positive developments in the market, especially during 2020. So, but most American investors were not looking at the stock. Why? Because it's listed on the wrong, again, in quotes, stock exchange. And this leads us to a potential catalyst down the road. Hmm. In case of GAN, the company actually relisted its shares from AIM, where it doesn't trade anymore, to NASDAQ earlier this year. Hmm. And going into that uplisting, this was the moment when the stock started getting discovered by American-focused investors who, of course, understand the trends such as iGaming, online sports betting, legalization wave going through the United States of America. They appreciate those trends a lot more than UK investors. So that's an example. And the stock has gone up literally 11x during our holding period.
Nice. All right. I have a bunch of questions here about this. The first one, from a purely logical perspective, if a company is American and its customers are in the US and its headquarters are in the US and all these other things, why would it not just list in the US?
That's a great question. So let's start there. So first, in case of GAN, for example, that was a European company. If I'm not mistaken, it was actually an Irish company listed in London. Mm-hmm. Can be wrong with this, it has been a while, could have been UK company listed in London. But that company had global ambitions and it's figured out that US would be the best fit for its product and given its business strategy. So in this case, it's a very logical European company. You happen to be listed in Europe. So that's one scenario. Now, there are also situations where US companies end up being listed on non-US stock exchanges. Very often it's Canada, it's close, across the border, obviously language similarities, strong democracy, rule of law, and everything. It's easy to do business.
Hold on, I like how you say there's language similarities between the US and Canada, but go on. Well, I'm pretty sure it's the same language, although some certain words being expressed differently. And anyway, go on.
Well, you know, it would have been better if I said the same phrase about the United Kingdom and US, you know, with the famous Mark Twain, I believe, quote, if I'm not mistaken, two nations divided by the common language. It would have been better if I used UK as an example, not Canada. So I messed up here. So it can be, very often it can be Canada, but sometimes it can be something else. It can be another stock exchange. So, and the question becomes, as you correctly pointed out, why would a US company do that? And generally, the answer is the cost of going public and the cost of being public and compliance cost. Okay. Standing securities lawyers who will understand those issues a lot better than I would and would have more informed opinion. But based on my research and understanding and conversations with industry participants, is for a small company, it's a lot cheaper to be public in Canada, for example, or on AIM than in the United States. Sarbanes-Oxley Act that was passed after the Enron and WorldCom debacle created a lot of benefits for the public market investors. However, it also created the disadvantages for smaller companies going public because it's just a lot more expensive to stay. And if you're a small company, those half a million or $1 million or more, they actually count. If you're early in your in your life cycle as a company, and you can reinvest that $1 million into customer acquisition and growing your customer base and reinvest at a higher investment rates, you don't want to spend that $1 million on administrative costs of being public. If you can save that, you can go public somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So that's typically the second reason why those role exchanges happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. But wouldn't there be more upside then also to listing in the US, like more liquidity and such? And the costs are bigger, but so is the upside, right?
I would suspect that the upside from the company's perspective and from the investor's perspective here would be very different. The frameworks they will be analyzing probably will be different. So let's talk about the company. If a company, hypothetically speaking, can go public in the US and be valued, I will just pick nice round numbers, 10x EBITDA, and it can raise some capital at that multiple and then use it for future growth. And we compare that situation to a scenario where the same company goes public, let's say in Canada or somewhere else, and it's valued at 5x EBITDA, then as a company, you should probably go public in the US because your implied cost of capital is a lot lower. So that would make sense. But if it's the same roughly valuation that you would get on two exchanges, you'll probably go way cheaper.
Sure, sure.
Also, I would not be surprised if some companies that successfully listed, let's say in Canada, may not have listed in the US at all.
Right.
Because they would have chose not to do that because of the costs. Mm. So that's also a possible scenario. In that case, you go with a cheaper exchange. Now, then the question becomes, Nate, what's the upside later on?
Right.
And this is you're going into another fascinating topic that I find super interesting, and I'm glad that we're getting there, which is this. At some point, if the company executes well, they keep the customers happy, they grow the customer count, they continue to innovate on their product or service, they keep growing revenue as a result of that, and they, because they scale, their margins expand, and they become more and more profitable company. Will a Rouen stock exchange, AIM, Canada, Canadian, Australian, anything else, something in Europe, will reward the same valuation as the US? And the answer is very often no. Mm. But remember, that's a fixable thing.
Sure.
I mentioned that again, after being public on AIM, probably, if I'm not mistaken, for slightly more than 6 years, it's relisted in the United States on NASDAQ. Mm. And there are plenty of other examples of companies that were listed in Canada, doing business mostly in the US. And once they reach a certain scale, they chose to relist on NASDAQ. And very often, that relisting or uplisting, also people call it, coincided and most likely was caused, not just correlation, but also causation, to a substantial increase in price of the shares, driven not only by strong execution and earnings and revenue growth, but also by multiple expansion. Yeah. So yeah, there's more upside of being listed in the US long-term. But you can always change that.
Yeah.
But your initial listing is not your sentence for life. You can change
that. Sure. Yeah. Okay, let's talk more now about these, exactly what you mean by the wrong exchanges. And I think pretty soon we should maybe move away from that nomenclature. But so you mentioned AIM, you mentioned Canada. Where else do you look? There's a lot of exchanges out there in the world. And so what else, which other ones would you consider? Where else have you been active? And what's your criteria for considering an exchange other than the US ones?
Okay, excellent. Let's discuss that. So yes, Canada, AIM. Another one would be Australian Stock Exchange.
Okay.
Again, this time...
Will they also speak English?
And again, you will not catch me with saying they speak the language similarities. They speak the same language. So again, it's just easier, right? I haven't done anything in New Zealand. My understanding is that it's very small stock exchange. And there are not that many companies listed, but obviously there's an example of Xero, which has been tremendous success of a company going out of there. But I would not be opposed to that. I hope to get at some point to get look into more. Also, Australia is a very interesting, in my opinion, country and exchange to look for ideas for this reason. So United States have an incredibly developed and robust venture capital and growth private equity ecosystem. If you are a talented entrepreneur who has ambitions to build a great company and you started already building up a product, guess what? You will probably raise VC money in Silicon Valley or New York or Boston or somewhere else. So you raise money, you keep building your product, then you raise the next round. And many companies can, as we're all aware, these days, companies that would have gone public at valuation of $1 billion, if it was 20 years ago, now they're going public at a valuation of $100 billion. And guess what it means for investors like me who invest in the public space? Those returns have been captured by private investors, either venture capital or private equity. Right. So, and again, there are a lot of advantages for that, but also there are disadvantages, especially for me, because it's more difficult to make money. Now, not every country in the world has as robust ecosystem on the venture and private equity side as the United States. Australia is an excellent example of that. Companies go public there a lot earlier. Now, to be clear, I'm not talking about a startup with a PowerPoint deck and a beta version of a product. No, I'm talking about a company that already has paying customers, already has decent revenue size, maybe even already either on the verge of breaking even or maybe already profitable. But in the US, they would just go and raise round D or round E or round C and will stay public a lot, private a lot longer. In Australia, apparently, and to be clear, I've never been to Australia, even though I'd love to, but my understanding is that in Australia, it's a lot more common for those companies to go public earlier.
All right.
And Australia, while it's a huge country, it's relatively small market. So many Australian companies, especially in technology, they actually have global ambitions. And US, obviously, is a huge market. So many of them choose as the next destination for their product and their expansion, United States. So there are several stories of CEOs actually moving to the United States of America, from Australia, relocating part of their team, building up the US team, and then you have these two offices, one in Australia, one in United States. Don't ask me how CEOs manage that given time difference. I'm sure it's a challenge and their working hours and sleeping hours may be a little bit awkward sometimes, but that's what they chose to and was the price they're willing to pay in order to grow the business and make it truly global. So again, from that perspective, I think Australia for me is a very interesting hunting ground.
I see. Okay. And so then what else, what other, there's a lot of exchanges in the world and a lot of them are a lot more liquid than Australia, but why would you exclude or include other ones?
Look, so normally I want to have company report English financials, okay. Financials in English, right? If it's hypothetically speaking, a German company with only German financials or Austrian company with only Austrian financials, it's going to be a wonderful business, mm-hmm. but it will be a lot more difficult for me to discover it and then do a proper analysis.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And also think about this. You know, there are always news items that will impact company's business. Maybe a new product launch was not a success. Maybe there are rumors about a competitor launching a competing product. And it probably will be reported in local media. It's a lot easier for me to pick it up if it's an English-speaking country.
Sure.
Germany. Again, may I invest? And again, I'm picking up Germany as an example of a country with, you know, developed markets with a lot of companies which language I do not speak. So the same would apply to Italy or Spain if they don't provide English financials. Mm-hmm. But they do provide English financials, and management is open to speaking with investors, then I would definitely consider investing in one of those companies in those countries. Mm-hmm. So I would want a company with strong rule of law, good requirements about disclosure, and overall environment that which is fairly business friendly. Mm-hmm. So now, does it mean that regulatory frameworks are as robust as the United States of America? Probably not. Mm. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. But if you focus more on the company and the quality of the management and the product, and you talk to customers and you come to the conclusion that it's a great customer value proposition and strong, and company has strong unit economics, you're making that bet more on the business.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And yeah, because the reason I ask is you everything that you mentioned just about holds true for two very big stock exchanges in Asia. I'm referring here, of course, to Singapore and Hong Kong, both of which do conduct business in English. And in fact, I remember a couple of years ago, if I'm not mistaken, there was a company, was it Prada, that listed in Singapore or Hong Kong, I can't remember which, but did not list in the US. And you see these stories periodically about companies listing in Hong Kong. And obviously you have that as a gateway to China. You have all these Chinese startups, but you don't look there in either of those places.
I have not invested in, throughout the life of Caracan Capital, I have not invested in companies that are listed in Hong Kong or in Singapore. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that I will never do it.
Okay.
But that's not what I have done historically. Okay. And remember, one thing that I pointed out for companies listed on AIM or in Australia or some other exchanges or Canada, very often it's a company with a US-centric business already.
Okay. Okay.
Or they want to become more heavily weighted towards the US in terms of their revenue mix, right? That's why they see a move to the United States. So with companies listed in Hong Kong or in Singapore, I don't expect it to be the case. They like to be conquering their local market.
Sure.
Like, it's the Chinese market, which is tremendous. It can be international Southeast Asian market for a company listed in Singapore. Again, my insights about those markets are likely to be less robust.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's, again, hypothetically, Australian company that does 60% business all over Australia,
mm-hmm.
of business in Australia, 10% of business in Europe, and 30% in the United States. I'm using that as a hypothetical numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
But we want to grow that 30% to 50, 60, 70. That's very different from a company that does 30% of business in Indonesia, 30 in Malaysia, 10 in Singapore, and the rest throughout other countries.
Yeah.
Different skills required, different type of diligence required.
Sure, sure. Okay, so what else do you look for in terms of criteria? Because obviously the exchange that they list on, that's just one very basic criteria when you're looking for compounders. So talk to me about that. What else you look for?
So I think that you alluded to that in your opening remarks is that everybody wants to find a compounder these days.
Mm.
And people always want to find compounders, but today it feels definitely the flavor of the day. It's an open question whether many compounders are overvalued or undervalued. I can make arguments both ways. And to be clear, many of them are terrific companies with strong unit economics. They have a history of consistent growth, margin expansion. They're doing fabulous things. So, but what I'm trying to find multi-bag opportunities. When I look for compounders, I try to find a multi-bag opportunity, which means generally that if I go and find something that is already widely perceived as a compounder, most likely a multi-bagger return potential over the next 2, 3, 4 years probably is not there. Not all of it, but it's all about probabilistic judgments. So I try to find those companies before they become apparent compounding machines, which means that if someone looks purely, this is what I mean by that name. If someone gives you financials or Visa or MasterCard for the past 5 or 10 years, and you look at them and you will say, wow, that's amazing business. I'd love to own it if the price is right. And then we can debate what is the right price. However, what I'm hoping to find, and this is where I spend my time and efforts and energy, is to find an opportunity where if someone looks at that and looks at the financials at the face value, you would not think that's a great compounding machine. Maybe margins are not there. Maybe you see growth, but margins are very mediocre. And maybe return on invested capital shows up very poorly. Instead of 40% that all of us would like to see, or at least 20, 25, Maybe it shows up at some low single digits, and it would be a normal reaction of a normal person, again, without reading more about the business, without talking to management, without talking to companies, to customers, will be, I don't want to own this, right? Mm. So, and the question, the next question is, okay, why they look that way, and why what I see there? And normally the answer is this. These companies are subscale. They are not showing typical financial attributes and characteristics of a successful compounder yet.
All right.
And then it's my job, through my diligence, is to figure out whether 2, 3, 4 years from now, those attributes will actually show up because they are built in the business, but because the business is still growing and maybe they have some growth pains. Maybe they need to invest more into geographic expansion. Maybe they're launching new product in the adjacent spaces. So it's like product extensions, which are done in a very smart way that eats into those margins. But then margins will expand, revenue growth will continue. And what now looks as 10% return on invested capital will become closer to 30% over the next several years, mm-hmm. especially if you look at the returns on incremental capital. So that's where I'm focusing on. So let me
point. Okay, so are there any particular industries or across the board?
Some industries naturally more scalable than others.
Sure.
So anything in technology and software related, it scales relatively easily. Mm. And the pattern of business analysis and pattern of financial analysis for those companies is fairly similar because there are certain metrics that matter for a company. And if you can analyze those, you can determine somewhat early that this business has a potential to be really successful.
All right.
So, and many of those things I learned from my friends who work in venture capital, years ago, because they invest. Now, those venture capital investors, they have, first of all, they invest in companies throughout all stages of their lives. So their pattern recognition is a lot better because they see them when it's round A, round B, round C, round D, et cetera. Sure. So that's number one. Number two, VC investors can always get private data because it's a private company. They will sign an NDA. They will get and they can analyze whatever they want. They can run all types of analysis, which we as public market investors cannot do because public companies disclose a lot less through financials than private companies will do to their venture capital investors. But you still can learn a lot from venture capital people, what frameworks to apply. And sometimes you may not have the same data as they would have, but you can read between the lines and try to triangulate different data points. Mm-hmm. So again, so software, technology, very scalable business. But it doesn't, sometimes it's consumer goods.
Okay.
Sometimes it's something else.
So then what types of metrics do you look for? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So the most important one is unit economics.
Okay.
What I mean by that is somewhat obvious. The company needs to be making money on every single customer or every single transaction. And ideally, they want to be making a lot of money relative to their costs.
Right.
So you want to see when a single transaction happens, when a single product is sold, or a single product is shipped, or their cash register rings, or a new customer signs up for services. You want the company to make a lot of money on that single transaction.
Okay.
And that generally is gross profit margin analysis.
Right.
And you try to understand what the customers pay. Very often you can do it through customer interviews or reading the customer reviews and doing all those things. And then you try to figure out what the costs are today. But also you want to figure out what the costs can be in the future.
Yeah.
The gross profit margin, as the company grows, very often it will scale. For example, in software as a service, it's not uncommon to see a smaller software business have 60% margin, gross profit margin, but as it grows, it can become 80.
Yeah.
Sometimes expansion is even more radical, and it goes from 50 to 80. Mm.
Okay, and the total addressable market, the TAM, that's pretty well established now as a model for what it would be, I guess, for software and stuff. And that's something that you can be, especially if they, based on their expansion plans and things like that, right?
So TAM will vary, right? TAM will vary depending on the vertical, depending on the product.
Sure, yeah.
On many, many variables. So it's always very individual analysis.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, it's not uncommon for the TAM to expand over time.
Right. Let's
take another example of a business that scales really well. Marketplaces. So obviously, when you're a marketplace that does 1,000 transactions a day, you're not really making money because you're losing money. Because having that infrastructure built requires money. It requires certain scale. But once you get to a certain point, your incremental margins are tremendously profitable. And there have been this economic studies as well. These points have been made by venture capitalists that as marketplace matures, very often the TAM will expand. And I think the classic example is the debate between Professor Dramadaran from New York University's Business School, Stern, and Bill Gurley from Benchmark, where they were debating the TAM for Uber. And Professor Dramadaran was looking at the total addressable market for taxi cabs.
Right.
And saying, hey, that's the number. That's what Uber is eating into. As a result, that's its maximum TAM and the valuation is crazy high. It was at the time when probably valuation of Uber was $7 or $8 billion, if I'm not mistaken. Mm. And Gurley's point was that look at data from San Francisco. And what we see is that after Uber launched in San Francisco, the TAM expanded. And I don't remember the number, I think it was 5 times.
Yeah.
So do I pay attention to TAM? Absolutely. But I also understand that it's case-by-case analysis and the TAM estimates are very often incorrect. And sometimes they can be incorrect, they're too high. And sometimes they're incorrect because they're too low.
Sure, sure. Okay, fair enough. All right, so you have the unit economics and what kind of valuations then are you looking for if you're going to make an entry point into one of these companies?
So it's all valuation about 2, 3, 4 years out. So it's all not today, right? So and normally you want to look at companies with comparable business models and see where they tend to trade given a certain level of return on invested capital or certain level of growth rate. And then you see their multiples and say, okay, if I can buy something that I think would look similar to those companies in 2, 3 years from now, and if I buy it at a substantial discount, then it's a very attractive entry point. And another thing that I would mention, Nate, other than unit economics, which generally manifests itself one way or another through gross profit margin, also the efficiency of customer acquisition costs.
Right.
So if you get a customer who will spend in the next 3 years with you $1,000 and your gross profit margin is 80%, and which means that over the next 3 years, you will make $800, but it will cost you $700 to acquire that customer today, then it's a lousy business. It doesn't matter that your gross profit margin is high today. You're not going to be making decent return long term. And on the NPV basis, you're actually losing money.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you also need to keep in mind that those customer acquisition costs are not static. They can go up, they can go down. If the business has viral potential, then it generally goes down. But in other cases, it will be going up because all early adopters got converted. But the mainstream, it's a lot more difficult to reach mainstream. So it's another metric that, which is critical for company success. But you need to be very careful when you analyze it. And by the way, so that was popularized mostly by software investors, but you can apply similar frameworks even for consumer goods, especially not like if you're buying a fridge or a microwave and you have it for the next 5 years, then your CAC is very different. It's a one-time, lifetime value is one-time transaction. So you need to be making money on your customer acquisition costs today. Otherwise, you're not making money.
Right.
But it's recurring one way or another, it's recurring or repeatable consumer transactions, then you can apply similar frameworks.
Mm-hmm. All right. Artem Fokin of Caro Can Capital. Very interesting conversation. I want to come back and dig in a little bit more with this and also actually get into some individual stocks later on in the program. But let's first take a short break. If you are a premium subscriber and you're listening to this, don't touch the dial because you will not get the break. And everybody else, if you want to become a premium subscriber, you can do so at the website contrarian.supercast.tech. Head over there and sign up. I need to tell you about Merck Research. MerckResearch.com, M-E-R-K. I read these reports on a regular basis and can absolutely recommend them.
their research is different. They do not cherry pick positive or negative charts, nor do they fall into the trap of confirmation bias. They have an intellectually consistent approach. They grew through a consistent set of relevant data, put them through the same consistent set of frameworks, and then summarized the whole thing in a checklist with a concise written summary. And now listeners of this podcast can take advantage of a special offer, which is a 3-month free trial to Merck Research. Simply visit the website merckresearch.com, sign up for one of the subscriptions, and enter the code CONTRARIAN at checkout to take advantage of this limited offer. That's merckresearch.com, M-E-R-K.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Artem Fokin. This is the segment of the show where we talk to our guest a little bit more about his background and how he came to this stage of his investing career. So curious to hear about that from you. You are currently based in the Bay Area, which of course is a very good place to hobnob, or was pre-COVID, with VC folks that you mentioned in the top half of the show. But yeah, talk to us a little bit more about your background, how you got into investing, and what happened to lead you to where you are today.
So Nate, I grew up in Russia, and I came to the US when I was 21 in 2004. I was trained in Russia as a lawyer, and then I came to the US to pursue a master in law degree. I graduated from New York University School of Law, and I did a LLM in tax law. So after that, I practiced for a few years in New York at a big international law firm. And when I started practicing, when I came, because I had this advantage of growing up in another country and getting legal education there, I started, and then I get only 1-year program, and I was licensed to be an attorney in the state of New York. I started practicing law when I was 22, 23. Wow. So which was early. And I practiced for a few years, and I worked at a firm. We worked a lot, obviously, with various investment firms, whether it's hedge funds or proprietary trades and desks at big banks or private equity investors, etc., and as well as big corporate clients. So, and I was really developing interest in what those clients are doing. So that's what led me to Stanford Business School. I graduated in 2011, and I spent most time there taking various investment classes. Stanford has a very, very strong investment curriculum, which kind of goes back to days of Phil Fisher, who then even taught there for a couple of years. And then Professor Jack McDonald developed a tremendous, tremendous program there. And after graduation, I worked at a hedge fund here in the Bay Area for a few years. And in early 2015, I launched Karakhan Capital and went on my own.
Nice. And so it's an equity hedge fund, obviously. And you try to find these compounders, and you also have a special situations bent sometimes, right?
Correct. So most of the positions in the portfolio fall into one of two buckets. Sometimes it's a blur, and we can touch upon that. But either it's special situations or compounders.
Okay.
The ideal situation is when a special situation happens, I find it, but through analysis, I actually realize that it can be a compounder. And then I buy a special situation, but then I end up holding it for an extended period of time as a compounder. That's the best. It always happened that way, but I love when it does.
What kind of special situations do you look for?
So the range is wide. It can be your classical, what Joel Greenblatt in his best-selling book wrote about. It can be spin-offs. It can be rights offering. Another pattern which I like is what I call two curves crossing. This is what I mean by that. Imagine a company that has some legacy boring decline in business. It declines 5-7% a year. Boring, horrible, melted ice cube. But there is a second division that is a lot younger. It's a lot smaller. Maybe today it's 20-30% of revenue. And that business is growing 30% a year. But the big business hides that hidden gem. And if you find those and you do a proper sum of the parts and you value a legacy business at some really low multiple because it just melts an ice cube, but you do proper analysis on the hidden gem, very often you will find an attractive opportunity. And then as a result, the stock, the company can be very, very attractive. And if the management is smart, or there is an activist investor involved, or there is a smart board of directors, or any combination of those conditions, it's very possible that the management will do the right things. And for example, they can sell the business, the legacy business, and focus only on the nice growing business. Or they may publicly communicate and say, we're gonna just use our legacy business as a cash cow, and we will take all that cash flow and channel into growing out and into our hidden gem business. So that would be another pattern. So the situations vary. And sometimes even those wrong exchanges, they are on the borderline of a special situation.
Let's talk now a little bit about certain areas that you find now are a little bit riper for picking to find these compounders. And it can be exchanges or certain segments of those markets. Before we drill down and you know, talk a little bit more, hopefully, about one or two holdings that you have. But yeah, big picture, are there any areas right now that you're finding more fruitful or more, yet more opportunistic right now?
I don't think, Nate, that that it really has changed over the past 12 months or even longer, mostly because I go based on my knowledge, right? What people call circle of competence. I go based on that and look within those, within that circle, what I can understand, what I can analyze, and what can I effectively diligence. So for example, finding customers is very important, because eventually it's the customer who defines the destiny of the business. If customers are happy, most likely the business will figure out how to be successful. And if the customers are not happy, it doesn't really matter what your margins are today, because chances are they will be lower in the future, one way or another. So that's why, again, I don't operate from a point of view what can be interesting today or what's the flavor of the day or what can get interesting tomorrow. I operate more, this is the industries which I believe know how to analyze and have experience of investing in. What am I seeing there by looking at individual companies and trying to find that hidden gem?
Okay. So, all right. So can we talk about hidden gems that you found recently, or maybe something that you've passed on at the last minute?
Sure. So let's pick an example of a portfolio holdings that fits into the theme what you and I have been talking about. Unnatural exchange. You see, we evolved from wrong exchange to unnatural exchange. So a software company that has experienced solid growth rate at this early in its life cycle, most likely if the company were in the US instead of Australia, it would have been not public. It probably kept raising money in the private markets, but it's already profitable, even though it's growing revenue very rapidly. So, and for the full disclaimer and disclosure, Karakhan Capital and its affiliates have a long position in the shares of a company called SkyFi. It's listed in Australia. It's a fairly young company. It's a few years old. It was launched by an entrepreneur from South Africa who lived in Australia at the time. And he raised some money in the private markets, built it to a certain scale, and then he took the company public in Australia. Again, when it was a relatively young company. The company makes software as a service and analytics tools that helps physical properties, physical locations, to analyze as well as optimize and redirect traffic patterns. I'll give you an example. Let's say you are a let's say you are a shopping mall or a big department store, or maybe you're a stadium. You want to analyze how people who visit your property move around, so that you can, if you're happy with the traffic, you know where you can put an additional vendor, for example.
So you're talking foot traffic.
Foot traffic. I'm talking about foot traffic. Alternatively, if you think that something creates a traffic jam of people, then you can change some layout. For example, another use case is airports. Airports are a big client of this company because they want to see traffic patterns. And by the way, with COVID-19, sadly, but luckily for this company, they actually get into more verticals, because more and more owners of physical locations, whether it's retail or airports or someone else, they want to understand how people move so that they don't congregate and don't create congestion in one area, because you want to spread them around. Similarly, the company, very quickly after COVID started, came up with a solution which is really people counting. So you go to a store, and the store knows, based on regulations, they cannot let more than 120 people in. Okay, you need to count that somehow, And you also want to communicate to clients or potential visitors that, listen, right now we have 120, but as soon as someone is out, we'll let you in, right? You want to have all those things. So that's what the company does. They have a really good, really robust analytics module, which clients like. Hmm. And the company went public, as I mentioned, in Australia a few years ago. And it was very natural in Australia to do so. In the US, would not have happened. Most of the revenue today comes from Australian and New Zealand markets. Company also is in Europe and also has business in the US. Now, they're growing in the US. Actually, CEO moved to the United States of America some time ago, lives in California, and he's also building up a team here. So, again, that fits into exchange. Now, the stock exchange was natural at the time when the company went public. Australian company runs most of the business in Australia, goes public in Australia, highly logical. However, the company has ambitions to become more global. That's why CEO now lives in the US. So likely, my expectation is that revenue mix will change. Hmm. Also, Australian investors are not as much in love with software as a service companies as American investors seem to be. Hmm. As a result, I would suspect and argue that if this company was trading in the US, the multiple assigned by the market would be substantially higher than it is today in Australia. Can the company release in the future? Well, company has not communicated anything on that point, but I would not be surprised that if in 2 or 3 or 4 years, revenue from the US is 80% or 70%, I would not be surprised that they may choose to do so. Who knows? It's a possibility. So that's an example of a company that illustrates a number of points.
Very interesting. I have a bunch of questions. So they develop technology that's able to track people in stores and such?
So it's a software. So they use the hardware that already most physical locations use. I'll give you an example. So one of the data sources that they rely on is Wi-Fi networks.
Oh, sure.
You will notice if you go to Westfield Mall in San Francisco, and by the way, I don't know whether Westfield Mall is their client. I think it's very possible. In San Francisco, I think it's very possible, but I don't really know whether Westfield Mall in San Francisco uses them. So, but if you go there, you probably will see that there is a free Wi-Fi.
Right.
And sometimes you will go and join for whatever reason. What is important, Nate, is that even if you don't join Wi-Fi, but your iPhone or your other smartphone device has Wi-Fi on, which most of us do, your device will be picked and counted by those Wi-Fi networks. This is my understanding of the technology and how it works. And through APIs, SkyFi will be able to get that information. They don't get personal identifiable information, of course, but they will recognize, as far as I understand how the tech works, you or me as a unique device who came to the store on Wednesday, December 23rd. Uh-huh. If we were shopping there, I suggest that we don't give them COVID. So that's one of the data sources. Other data source can be cameras. Right?
Sure.
If you go to a store, guess what? There are cameras. They can be used for security reasons, so people don't engage in illegal activities such as larceny, which is a legal term for stealing.
I was going to say shoplifting, but yeah.
Yeah, as you see, my legal background and taking the bar exam in New York shows up sometimes. So, again, cameras, right? Most stores already have those cameras. What SkyFi will do, they will connect through APIs and get the data source as well. They also use some heat maps, and they use different things, but a few sources of data that they get. Once they get, this is where kind of the magic, so to speak, happens, where they will analyze the data, slice it and dice it, and present to the customers in a way that the customer can generate actionable insights.
Nice. Wow, that's fascinating. How do their customer base break down between, you know, malls versus airports?
So they have a lot of different customer types, right?
Okay.
I would not be able to tell you exact breakdown between malls versus airports, but it's malls, it's airports, it's stadiums, it's department stores, they started getting more and more into grocery channel after COVID started. Historically, they were not very well represented in the grocery channel. However, you know, grocery, even after COVID started, groceries because all of us need to buy food. So grocery stores are open, but grocery stores need to prevent COVID from spreading, need to count people, need to manage all those things. So they became, the penetration of Skyfi within grocery channel has gone up a lot. Hmm. So they are pretty reasonably diversified across different customers. Mm-hmm. Now, another important thing is to keep in mind is this. If you sign up, I'm making this up, but if you sign up a big stadium or big airport, they will be paying you more money, or they, let's say they will be paying you the same amount of money as if you sign up a restaurant chain or a chain of grocery stores, even if they have 50 locations. Numbers are highly hypothetical. I'm using this as an example. I'm not saying this is exactly correct. So it's not just the customer count. It's also your revenue breakdown, how much money derived where.
Interesting. Wow, that's fascinating. I was going to say, for airports, if you really want to find out what where these loggerheads are, you just kind of maybe speed up the whole like security thing. I mean, that's where it all is, right? It's all, at least in the US.
Traffic jams for sure.
Yeah. Anyway, okay, that's fascinating. Yeah, because the reason I asked is because I was wondering how much COVID had affected their business. If you know, their clients are malls and stadiums, which, and even airports, which now are not really being used. I mean, airports are, but the others aren't.
So excellent question. So a couple of things there, right? So first, historically, and this was fascinating conversation. So when I first met CEO, Wayne, and I asked him, obviously, it's a software business, so there are certain questions that I always ask. So one of them, like, what's your churn? He says 3%. I agree. So I, okay. And then later, when I go through my notes, you know, clean them up, because obviously I was typing during the conversation, and then I see 3%. I'm like, okay, probably a year, I'm thinking, which is a great metric for any software business. If you have 3% customer churn, it's terrific. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know what? Maybe I should have clarified. What if it's a per month? Mm. I don't think it's per month, because that will be crazy high, and it's really, in that case, a big problem. But I should really ask next time when I speak with Wayne. So I do some work on the company, read more, then I connect with him again. So I ask, I have more questions, I ask him, and then I get to my churn questions. Like, so Wayne, remember last time when we spoke with you, you told me that your churn is 10%. Just to clarify, is this per year? He says, no. I'm like, oh my God, I just wasted a lot of time researching the company. He's like, no, that's from inception.
Wow.
I was like, sorry. You're telling me that you've been in business for a number of years and your churn is 3%? But yeah, I like it. That's amazing. Like, that's a great metric. It's even better than I first thought. So that's an example. Now, during COVID, some customers obviously had financial difficulties because they're not really functioning.
Sure.
And they temper, and Skyfi, in my opinion, did the right thing. They, as far as I understand, Skyfi agreed to kind of pause their accounts. Not cancel, but pause. Again, those contracts are typically have certain cancellation clauses, so you cannot just say, you know what, I'm not paying you. But from building up goodwill with your customers, in my opinion, it's the right thing to do, if you can afford it, to say, don't worry, I get it, you're in a difficult time right now. Maybe your department store is closed. Maybe your restaurant is closed. Maybe something else is closed. I get it. Let's put it on hold for the next 3 months and then we'll take it from there. The company, a business can sustain that pause, and Skyfi was in a position that it was able to, I think is the right thing to do. Because your customers will be more loyal. They will like you more. They will remember you as guys who helped you when you were in a tough spot. Hmm. So overall, COVID had some short-term impact on them when they paused those payments, and their revenue would have been better if they insisted on getting those payments. But I think it was the right thing to do strategically, number one. Number two, most of those paused have been unpaused and they went back based on the last reported financials. And they're also penetrating grocery a lot better than they used to.
Wow. Okay. And so this is a Skyfi, and they trade in Australia for now. What's the symbol? Do they have a symbol in Australia? Have numbers, I forget.
The ticker in Australia is SSM, K as Kevin, F as Frank.
SKF. Okay. Right. And again, just to be clear, neither Artem nor myself are recommending an investment in this. He already disclosed that his firm does have a position. I do not have a position in this. And as is the due course with anything that we discuss, I will not, I do not intend to take a position in this, just to keep everything clear. Do they have any plans to come to the US or anywhere else soon, do you know, that you know of?
In terms of listing?
Yeah.
Look, I don't think there is, based on what I know, I don't believe there is any definite plan of the company doing relisting in the US today, but I think it's probably on the table, and I would suspect that it's probably will be an option once the company gets bigger revenue base, where remember you guys spoke about costs of compliance and being public in the US and all those things. So I think it would make more sense when the company gets a bit bigger. Mm. I would, again, this is pure speculation on my part, just given my experience and pattern recognition. I would say probably in 2-3 years, I think relisting is quite likely. Mm-hmm. I probably would not expect it in the next 12 or even 24 months, but who knows? If you're wrong. I kind of was surprised.
Very interesting. Wow. Fascinating conversation, Artem Fokin, and the art of finding compounders in unusual places, such as wrong exchanges. Thank you so much for the conversation. Maybe in closing, how can people find out about you and find out more about you and the firm? I'll put this in the show notes as well.
I think the best way to get in touch is through the website. It's www.caro-kann-capital.com, and I'll spell it caro-kann-capital.com. And for those people who are chess enthusiasts, they will obviously recognize it as a chess opening. And for those who don't necessarily recognize the name, that's why I spelled it out.
Uh-huh. Okay. I was actually going to ask what the origins of the name are. I have not seen The Queen's Gambit. So have you?
Yeah, I have not seen it either, even though many, many friends texted, emailed, WhatsApped, or used whatever medium of communication I use with them, saying to me, it's a great TV series, it's about chess, you got to watch it, you will love it, and Caro Kann is even mentioned there. So, but I have not watched it yet, maybe one day I will.
Oh, it mentions Caro Kann?
That's what my friends told me.
Okay, well then maybe more people will know it than we think.
Nate, I don't even have Netflix, right?
Oh, God. Well, I'm going to take that out because that doesn't look good for a guy who's in the Bay Area and a tech guy. No, I'm kidding.
No, definitely, definitely. But we don't even have Netflix. Mostly, wow. I would rather eliminate potential distractions, but maybe I will sign up for 1 month and listen.
Yeah. That's the whole point about it. I'm not a huge Netflix fan, but that's the whole point is you don't have to watch, it's not a distraction. You only watch it when you want to. Of course, then if you get into something and you binge it, then you lose sleep. So there is that.
And I'd rather avoid that.
Yeah, I understand that. All right. Wonderful. Artem Fokin, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. Thank you all for listening. And I look forward to speaking to you all again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time. Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.